Linda Braun.
Hi, it's Ed Verney. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, it's Ed Verney.
Yeah, this is Barry Kirstein.
Hi, Barry.
Pauline?
Hello?
Mary Church?
Hi, this is Sarah Alvarado calling.
Hi, this is Ron Bruckman.
Hello.
Caleb Stewart is here.
Hi, Caleb. Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Good evening, this is Mary Church.
Hi, Mary.
Bill Ryman.
Hi.
Pauline Church is here as well.
Oh. We've been tight.
Yeah, which slide deck are we using tonight?
Linda Janak.
Hi, Linda. We're
Hi.
Talking about hiring and the networking. It's open with.
Great.
Linda?
Yes.
Hi, it's Sarah Alvarado.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
Hey. So do you know how many people are online?
There's supposed to be 70. I have no idea who's on now.
Dave Levy.
Avery Schlechtman.
Steve Grass.
Sue Reed.
Hi, this is Sheila Keegan-Nurmi joining the call.
Hi, this is Dennis Arbo.
I have to figure out how to mute my phone here, so.
Six.
Hello, this is Jack Molesky.
Hello, Jack.
Jack Richardson as well. Ah, are you got a monitor there or something?
Try again.
Mark's
hey,
Anita Modere.
Rob Dandridge.
Hey, this is Jack Molesky. I'm the moderator of the call tonight. This is the Deck Connection job conference call. And we'll get started in about 4 or 5 minutes here, but just a couple rules for those of you that are coming on. We expect 70 to 80 people to be on this conference call, so we would like you to mute your phone. And to mute your phone, you press *6. If you wish to get on again, then you press *6 to speak. So with 70 to 80 people on the phone, we would appreciate it if you could mute your phone because dogs are barking and whatever would kind of disturb the call. So in any case, we're going to wait 3 or 4 minutes here. I will be moderating the call. We will have four agenda items. Who is hiring, interviewing and networking, changing careers, and consulting as a career. And we have three ex-digital experts that have a very distinguished career both at digital and otherwise. that will be leading this conversation. And what I would like to ask people, in addition to muting their phone, is that we will allow each speaker for each of the topics to speak for 15 minutes. We ask that you hold your questions. We have the second hour, actually a little more than the second hour, for questions. We did ask people to submit their questions to the speakers, and we have passed all those questions on to the speakers, and hopefully they will address that. If not, there will be a question and answer period after each of the four topics are covered. And if your question doesn't get answered then or during the question and answer period, you can submit them again and the speakers will respond to that. So that's the agenda for tonight. Again, I'm the moderator. I will only come in to moderate the call, and hopefully the speakers will be able to go through their process and their 15 minutes without any interruption otherwise. We have Who is Hiring, which is Sarah Alvarado, who is based in Phoenix, Arizona. She is 25 years in recruitment in high-tech, aerospace, and healthcare industries. We have Linda Genak, who is going to cover interviewing and networking and changing careers. And she is based in Austin, Texas, and has her own company, the Genak Group. And finally, we'll be discussing consulting as a career with Caleb Stewart, who is the co-founder of Randolph Associates. Many of you at Digital probably remember Randolph Associates. I used to get tons of resumes from them, and he is still there as a vice president. So that's the agenda for the evening, and I want to ask the speakers if they are present. Sarah, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Linda? Linda's not yet here. Okay, how about Caleb?
Unmute.
Sorry. Sorry, I missed that.
Linda's here. I had to unmute.
Okay, Linda's here. Caleb, are you here?
Caleb is here.
Okay, unless there are any other questions, we'll begin with Sarah on who is hiring. And again, I would encourage you to mute your phone. You can mute that by pressing *6. Sarah, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. What wasn't on my profile, and which I'd like to also bring up, is that after reading the questions that are coming in, I started out in Massachusetts. I was born and raised in Massachusetts, and then I went with Digital to the Silicon Valley in California, where I ramped up their Alpha chip. And because of the whispers that were going on in regard to either debt closing or there was more layoffs happening, I started interviewing, and that was part of my five-year goal, and that's another piece around who is hiring, is to start to think about what you want to do for future. Always think about what you want to do, whether it's 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now. When I lived in Massachusetts, my goal was to eventually start recruiting in the Silicon Valley to see what that competition was like, and there I had the opportunity to do so. When I left Digital, I went over to Intel Corporation, and where I ramped up their Pentium 2. During that time period, I was able to have the opportunity to come to Arizona, where I was able to ramp up their fabrication site. It was the first one here in Arizona, and it was a state that never heard about Intel Corporation. So it was really an interesting experience, and I've been in Arizona since, and dealing with 105 to 112 degrees. So again, just to give you some information, I have some experience knowing what it's like to be in a competitive environment as well as deep-rooted environment, which was Massachusetts and now here in Arizona, which tends to be a transient state because a lot of people from a lot of different states do come to Arizona to live, or they're here usually in the winter time. Now, to start off with the topic of who is hiring, there was a link that was sent out that said who is hiring. And this link I found, which I thought was very, very interesting because of the fact that it does list various companies that you can take a look, and they state, here's who's hiring as well as other information. Now, in order to find out where companies are hiring, I always believed in being a creative recruiter, or right now, being unemployed myself, I'm in the basket with a lot of other people who are looking for opportunities, and this is really the time to be creative. As a recruiter, one thing that I always found out to be so is don't give up. Because, for example, companies, even though they may be on a hiring freeze or they're not hiring at this point, they are still gathering resumes for a pipeline. And I've also had the opportunity to see where a company will turn around and hire someone that there may not even be a job description for, because all of a sudden this person brings to the table skills that the hiring manager never thought of before. And usually behind every hiring manager, there is a person who may be the lead person in his or her group that usually looks at the resumes. And I'm giving you some recruiter secrets, so this can help you to understand what is on the other end. Now, when you see different companies that are of interest, or say you're in a company and you're like, a person sent me a question that he will be leaving EMC in late June. To start your process, my suggestion is to put together a plan. And that plan is, you felt comfortable at EMC, or you felt comfortable at the company you were with, especially if being there for quite a while, is the fact to look up who is this company's competitors. Because usually what will happen is they'll have the similar jobs, they'll have the similar type of environment. The only exceptional, when I say environment, is digital. Digital Corporation was a very relationship-oriented company. And that's another key factor, is the culture. Because what happened is, for me, when I left Digital and went into Intel Corporation, I was in a state of shock for 9 months. Intel was a very results-oriented company, get-to-the-point company, where at Digital, things were done through people. It was considered the most networked company in the world, based on big companies. So that's something to bear in mind. And sometimes it's not the job. It's not only the job that you can do, but the thing that you may not work well with is the culture. And my suggestion to that around who is hiring is the fact to find out or talk to people who may know people that can tell you a piece of what that environment is like and what that culture is like. And going through the particular slide around who is hiring, my suggestion is to use this as an example. Go in and take a look at it. Look up some of the companies. And again, don't be dismayed if you don't see any jobs in those companies, because these particular big companies will always be hiring. And sometimes when they say they're not hiring, other groups are hiring within that company. So the piece is just don't give up. The other piece, which has not been on, I noticed that is not on the slide, are my other topics that I was going to talk about, who is hiring. It's like, how do I find out about companies? Well, there's different areas that you can find out. Number one, you go to job boards. Take a look at specifically, you know, what companies are doing a lot of hiring. You can call them up by companies. You can take a look at the job boards and see what type of jobs they do have. And if you don't see something for you, one of the main things that I would suggest, especially if you're interested in that specific company, is to turn around and take a look at maybe some of the job descriptions that they may have and ask yourself the question, is my resume, even though I can do some of these jobs, do I have the right verbiage in there? Because nowadays, it's not the recruiter reading the resume so much. What all companies have put together is these applicant tracking systems. And what these applicant tracking systems do is they highlight keywords of resumes being sent in. So say, for example, you may see something on Career Builder that interests you. Well, you send your resume in, and that specific company is going to have the specific words. So my suggestion strongly is it may take a couple times, but you may have to turn around and make sure that your resume is carrying these verbiages so it'll stand out when your resume is submitted. Now, another avenue, too, other than job boards, and when I was trying to recruit and find people, especially... hello? Did someone have a question for me? Okay. What I found out is that there was a time at Intel where we downsized over 1,000 people, and instead of us going out and utilizing an outplacement firm such as Wright Management, Drake Beeman Moore, or Lee Hecht Harrison, which were the three major outplacement places, is we formed our own outplacement firm. And I was the senior job developer, so my job was to find jobs for all the folks that were being displaced within Intel on the outside. And one of the techniques I used, and again, I don't know if this is something that you may think about, but it is a good resource. The Chamber of Commerce puts out in every state a book, and it lists every single company by focus. For example, you'll have a section on manufacturing, you'll have a section on retail, you'll have a section on, say, medical. And inside each of those sections, you'll find the names of the companies, how many people are working for that company, and you'll also have contacts in there. And it doesn't hurt to give them a call and see where they are in their hiring or if there's any, could be any opportunities for you. Not like the old days where, God, it was easy to send your resume in and, you know, people would call and so forth. This has become a very tough time in the arena of looking for a job. I can vouch for that as a recruiter because if companies are downsizing, then there's no jobs for recruiters. And the piece that I strongly, strongly suggest, it's going to take more of the person who is looking for a job to become more creative in that avenue. It has become an employee market, which means that you're going to be up against other folks who are looking for a job, more so than it is a company's market at this particular time. Now, the way companies operate is twofold. One is when they have a particular job description that is going to be posted, they have to post it internally for 10 days. Sometimes some companies will go in and post their job externally at the same time because they may have a candidate that they're interested in or they want to turn around and see who internally has posted. This is a legal thing for a company to do because it gives a person who may be out in disability or who may be out on medical leave or who may be out on jury duty the opportunity to come back and see that this job is being posted internally so that they can apply for the job as well. Another thing that I used to do, and again, what I'm doing basically in the Who is Hiring is I'm giving you some recruiter secrets. Another thing I did was e-scans. Now, e-scans is covering a particular state. So if you are open to moving, my suggestion is maybe putting an e-scan together. Again, trying to find out companies that do tailor to your specific skill set within a certain area and see if they are there. And if they're not there, then you need to take a look at, well, what am I going to do if I want to work? Does this mean I am going to have to transfer my skills and to get into something different? Always remember one thing. If you're going to be going looking for a job and it's going to be different than what you are already doing, take a look at your skill sets and see if they can be transferable. Now, somebody sent me an email and they wanted to know about the 55 plus. Well, the 55 plus, that's considered under the realm of diversity right now. And diversity recruitment means that they do not have a well-balanced workforce or a particular group wants to balance their workforce. And so right now that is an opportunity for someone who may be looking for a particular position. And there is a link that you can take a look at and on board, and it's called welcometojobsover50.com. So it's JOBS, capital O, V as in Victor, ER, 50.com. And this is a site for the baby boomers and retirees. So I wanted to make sure that I was able to answer that question from someone who had sent me in. Linda's going to be covering more about changing careers and networking and so forth. But I just want to iterate one thing. I found that out of all the various associations, even though associations are great, is that LinkedIn has been very, very effective. Because of the fact that as you build up your network, it's in your network that's going to be able to tell you exactly where the folks that are tied into you, where they are, so that you can ask them questions. But also up above in the search space, you can call up company or you can call up people and in those companies, and what it'll do is it'll list the recruiter's names. It'll also list exactly different places where this particular company is and so forth. So this, again, is another piece of information that would be of asset to you. Now, if you've been recently laid off, I want to explain, and Linda will go into it even further, is the fact that the unemployment office is going to have opportunities listed there. I strongly suggest check it once in a while. Get online if you feel like you don't want to go in there. But you also have the workforce development groups, which are part of the state, but they're separate from the DES because they're two different places. Those are avenues worth looking into as well. And also, boy, I've never talked so fast in my life, and everybody says that I'm a fast talker. Let's see here. I want to make sure of something here. Okay. The other piece, too, is people want to know, as far as who is hiring, they asked about relocation. Again, companies are open to relocation, but what I'm trying to say, and the main thing that really blinked my eyes was when there wasn't any jobs, and yet when resumes came through those applicant tracking systems, managers sometimes sit down and play with those tracking systems as well as recruiters. Now, as far as I'm concerned, there's three types of recruiters, and this is why it's very, very key for you to make sure that your resume is understandable, especially with the keywords. You have junior recruiters who have just started. They've only had less than a year of recruiting experience. So, again, they're only at a certain point where they can discuss things or their knowledge base may be. You also have recruiters that have gone in that I call paper pushers. And these folks, what they do is as long as they get a lot of paper, they want to impress the hiring manager and send those papers. And again, the one thing I want to add is the fact that if your resume is set up in a way that you see jobs from a specific company that you're very much interested in, tailor make your resume to hit those words. And on the other hand, if you're experienced and you feel, well, maybe I'm too overqualified, never think that way. Because what happens is, if you see in that particular job description that there's another skill set that you have that you feel you can add to, put that in, because the system will pick up that key word. And that hiring manager who never thought about perhaps that particular skill set could probably have an interest. Because one of the things is the third set of recruiters that I know of, and I myself consider myself to be one of them, I've always sat down with a hiring manager and gone over the skills and the job description. And the problem sometimes with hiring managers is they'll turn around and try to write a job description similar to themselves. What they're not looking at is the fact that there are new skill sets coming in on that specific section. And what I try to do is to try to keep it open so that if you're writing a job description, there's at least 80% of skill sets that you would be looking for, and the other 20% would be for development. So I just thought that that would be a key point in bringing in, because in all cases, people feel, well, I'll just check the job board. Well, one of the things that is very important is the fact behind every person nowadays is 100 people they know. And through those people, there are other people which can help and support you. People who also that may have been in other jobs or other companies that you had worked with. Now is the time to get back and get reconnected with those folks. And I'm sure that Linda's going to be covering more of that. Now, associations, who is hiring under that? Well, separating that from groups to belong to, if you're considering and looking at opening your own business, and again, Linda, I'm sure we'll be bringing that in a little bit more, but your small business partners, there's associations of small business groups in each state. And what it is a community of retired professionals who have geared up their own business or have been in business, that they're open to talking to you about what it's like to start a business. You can confer with them about your ideas and your focus, and they themselves can try to help you out. Now, having said all that, and I don't know, I think in about 10 minutes, I hope I've covered everything in the art of who is hiring. But the key thing I want to say to you, and the words that I kept mulling through my head is, everybody is really hiring. Sometimes it's who you know, and the other piece is, too, they haven't thought of the job yet. And the key is to get your resume in there. But the other thing, too, to understand is the fact, once your resume is submitted into a company, and this is very, very important, is to make sure that you have the right verbiage that's stating on that job description, as well as other skill sets that you think may be needed, that you have that's not displayed on that. Because those applicant tracking systems is now what's going on in every single company. And they're the ones that are going to scan those keywords and make you show up in front of the recruiter or show up in front of the hiring manager. With that, I'm open to questions. If I hope I've answered or my presentation was helpful in this respect.
This is Jack Molesky, the moderator. Thank you very much, Sarah. I'm going to hold the questions here just to make sure that we get through the topics, and we will have
okay. A
question and answer period at the end for all the panelists. And for those of you that signed up after I had given my original presentation, keep your phone on mute, which is *6. We will have questions at the end. This is being recorded, so we will post the interview on the Deck Connection website after the con call is completed. And I'd now like to go to interviewing and networking with Linda. Linda?
Yes, thank you. And I think what I'm going to do is start off with changing careers and then filter in the networking and interviewing, since that is really kind of the more implementation side of the house. So what we're going to talk about today are really defining the nature of a career change. There are many dimensions of change, and what I find most people do when they come into my office is they look at career change one-dimensionally. Then we'll talk about how to assess your risk for making that sort of change, determining the timeline, how to perform what we call a skill or a talent gap analysis. In other words, what are your skills today? And if you're going to make a change, what are the skills that are required of that future job, and how do you figure out what's missing? So that you can build a skills roadmap to acquire the additional competencies that you need to move forward. And then finally, we'll talk about rebranding and recasting yourself, and that's where some of the networking and interviewing will come into play. So I developed something a little over 10 years ago when I got into the career transition business. And when I say career transition, it has nothing to do with recruiting at all. It really is helping someone identify what it is they're doing now, what it is they want to do, and building the plan to get there. And the model that I created really has four quadrants. And these quadrants include, if you want to remain in the same industry, in the same career, that to me is a job change. And I'll explain a little bit about what that is in a second. If you want to stay in the same industry but move into a new career, that really is a career change. If you'd like to move into a new industry but stay in the same career, that's really an industry shift. And if you want to move into an entirely new industry and a brand new career, that is a complete transformation. What does that really look like? Well, if you were a marketing manager and you were at Dell and you wanted to move from Dell to Hewlett-Packard and stay in the marketing field, that's a job change. And the types of services that you would get would be mostly tactical in nature. i.e., you know, how do you find a job and who's hiring? Some of what Sarah talked to. If you wanted to develop your career, for example, if you were a marketing manager and you wanted to move in a like career, i.e. sales or business development, where the skills that are overlapping are more than 50% similar, That's really more of a career shift. That's what we would traditionally call moving up the career ladder. If you wanted to make an industry change, so you're a marketing manager and you were working at a high-tech company or a manufacturing company like Dell, and you wanted to move to a healthcare company, that's an industry shift. And the things that you have to look at are, what are those industry trends that are happening? What is the new technology, the new language? And how is marketing done differently in a healthcare profession, i.e. lots of compliance, versus somewhere like a technology company? A transformation is one where you say, I no longer want to be in marketing. I no longer want to be in technology. I want to do something that's completely different. I want to open a bagel shop. I want to, you know, create vodka, or I want to start a consulting company. That is going to be a transformation. And when you're thinking about how to assess what type of change that you want to make, you really have to think about a couple of things. First and foremost, you need to think about your financial horizon. If you're going to make a complete transformation, that is going to take a lot longer to do than a simple job change. And job change is not simple. So I typically tell people, if you are completely transforming yourself, you need to really think about a minimum timeline of 6 months. And oftentimes people will say, well, I don't have that long. And I say, you do have that long, because I have been with people who have gone without a job for 2 years, and then they come to me and say, I should have started with you 2 years ago because I'm still unemployed. In this economy, you have no idea how long you're going to be employed, so it is best to take action now, and we'll talk about how to do that in a minute, because there are many ways you can take action on any one of these strategies. But you need to think of finances. So I tell people, you need to have a minimum of 6 months' worth of income so that you can afford to go through a change. Now, that can happen in many ways. You can, you know, if you have a significant other that wasn't working, maybe that significant other can go back to work, find a part-time job in the meantime so that you can pursue your full transformation. And there are other things that you can do that we can get into, but it would take me forever to talk about it. If you're thinking, another thing in addition to finances, is you need to think about complexity. There are, you know, if making a transformation requires you to go back to school and earn a different degree, whether it be another bachelor's or a master's, sometimes that's going to take, you know, up to 2 years, sometimes a little bit more. Certifications you can get a little bit faster, and we'll talk about that, but it still requires time and money. Those are very important things, but I think what the most important thing that you need to consider when you're going through a change is your emotional state. No matter what type of career change you're in, whether it's just being laid off and you have to get another job because it has to pay the bills, which for most of us, that certainly is the case, especially in our economy today, is something that needs to be considered, because most people who go through changes, what they want to do is they automatically resort back to their old behavior, their old habits, their old storytelling, their old brand, because they get uncomfortable or they get fearful. I have worked with thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have gone through simple transitions to complex transitions, and I'm talking anything from somebody who's a doctor to becoming a salesperson, to a salesperson becoming a teacher, across dozens of industries, including biotech, high-tech, government. Doesn't matter if they were a CEO or an individual contributor, the emotional trauma of making a career change is frightening, it's scary, you're in limbo, you don't know which way to turn, you need to make money, you got to pay the bills, so it can be very, very challenging. And the way that I handle that with people, once I understand, you know, what's their ability to handle risk, their finance, their emotional state, the type of transformation they want, where they are in their skill set and where they want to be, then I start to determine, okay, if this person has to get a job right now because they have to pay the bills, they're on their last dime, what I typically do is figure out how to apply what I call a serial approach to the career transition. And that, what I mean, there's serial and parallel, and I'm not going to talk anything beyond there because those are the two most popular ways to go about change. In a serial process, what I try to determine first and foremost is what are the competencies, the knowledge, the skills, and the abilities that an individual person has within the profession that they have been at for however long, 10, 20, 30, 40, whatever, how many years they have. In the case that I'm going to use, we're going to talk a little bit about an engineer, and this is a real case. I had a civil engineer, actually had a high-tech software engineer who wanted to get into sales management. Over the course of the last 10 years of his career, every door that he's ever tried to break into, from his current manager to new companies, slammed the door in his face, because once you're an engineer, you're always an engineer. That is what you will deal with as you make a career change. That's fundamentally how we were taught to think. That is fundamentally how people react when you're dealing with the hiring manager, because they need to hire for a specific skill set. So it takes a very keen person, meaning you, to figure out who you are, what skills you have. What I have found doing this over 10 years is most people don't really know what skills they have. They look at a job description and they list, oh, if this is what it says for an engineer, these are the skills that I must have. And they very narrowly. What I do is I broaden that, and I'm going to give you a website to help you figure out what some of your skills are. But what I do first and foremost is figure out, based on this person's values, interests, skills, abilities, competencies, talents, experience, their kind of authentic self, their hobbies, everything. And I do an entire inventory of who is this person. And I figure out, I put it basically in a column, and you'll see that in my presentation. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. And I put it in a column. Then I figure out where they need to be. And if it's sales manager, I figure out what are the bare minimum competencies an individual must have in order to perform as a sales manager. And so that's the other spectrum. And then there's all this stuff in between. Well, if this person has to move from engineer to sales manager, that would be an abrupt change. Most changes don't happen that way. What happens is they go in a serial approach. So I ask myself, what is the position that's closest to engineering that will move that person towards a sales management position? And in this case, what was most applicable was sales engineer. It had both a technical component and then a bare bones sales, basically sales assistant component, where you're partnered with a salesperson so you can learn a little bit about sales. And then over time, what happened is he moved from engineer to sales support, which was 50% sales because it was inside sales, then sales associate, where he was selling outside, hitting the numbers, figuring out how to do it in sales manager. And that took about 3 to 3.5 years to do. That a serial approach is going to take the longest, but it is the most practical approach to career change. Now, in my case, I did what I call a parallel approach. So given my background at digital and then all the high-tech companies that I joined, my experience was in marketing. But I didn't want to do marketing anymore. I was sick of it. I was tired. It was making me miserable. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. So when my company had a layoff, I used that as an opportunity to help people make transitions. And that's how I started my career. But I had to work. We have a dual-income household. So I said to myself, how can I deliver marketing services as a consultant while building up this career coaching practice? And what I did in parallel was most of my income, I would say 90% of my income, came from consulting gigs. And then at night and on the weekends, I would provide career coaching for free to get experience. Then over time, what happened was I started charging. And then as I started to get more and more clients, I started to decrease the number of consulting hours until I hit a crux where I was doing about 50% marketing and 50% coaching, and I almost had to make a shift where I knew I would lose some income, But in order to build the business, I had to at some point say, I need that other 50% of time to grow more clients in the career coaching if that's what I'm going to do. And that is what a parallel approach is. It's actually doing two careers in parallel. One is typically either building a business. You might be doing it as a volunteer. You might be doing it as a what we're calling the new breed of interns, or it's some paid work somehow to get the experience for those new competencies that you've gained. It's a lot harder because you don't have a personal life, for one. You're spending in a tremendous amount of time over the course of 1 year, and this is kind of really what I'm going to look at, where family time is definitely encroached upon. Spending time with friends is not a lot there. It's an investment. It's like it's earning your degree and working full time. That's what it's like. And it can be stressful and it's time consuming, but that is, again, the second most practical approach to change. When you do the parallel approach, the benefit there, that it happens a lot faster than serial. So going from, a marketing person to a career coach happened in a couple of years rather than 3 or 4 years. So that can be interesting. So, in terms of the gap analysis, how do you determine what you need? Well, first and foremost, as I said, you've got to list all the skills. And what I typically do is I go out to a place called Onet, and I have a website link in there that you'll be able to visit. And I look, what is the recommended proficiency for entry level? If somebody was going to get into this entry level, what does it look like? And I look at all, and it's dozens and dozens and dozens of tasks that you will see. Then what I do is I say, okay, you need to do a self-assessment based on all of the areas that we've listed on this new job, on this new career. Where do you think you have some presence, minimal presence, or no presence in skill? Sometimes we will use a former manager or a friend to help get it a little bit more objective. Sometimes I use tools like brainbench.com, who will help assess any skill, any talent, any ability that you have on a scale of novice to expert. And so we use some of those tools to figure out where you are. And then once we figure out what the gap is the difference between your current skill and the skill that's needed. Then what I do is I say, how do we fill the gap? And that's a loaded question, because you can put it on many types of timelines and horizons. And the example that I provided in the slides are year one, year two, and year three. I have helped people make transitions in less than 45 days. It's extremely stressful, but it can be done, and I don't recommend it. So, for example, what you have to ask yourself is, in order to move into, in the example that I said, if you're an engineer and you're moving into sales engineer, what are all the fundamental skills and knowledge that you need to gain in order to, one, get into that role, and then, two, become proficient in that role in order to land a job? Somebody said, does certification help? Yeah, there is actually a certification program for practically anything, some unregulated, some regulated, but it is only the first step. It is absolutely helpful, but it is only a first step. More is required to get your foot in the door, and that is a combination of gaining the skills and then being a fabulous marketing/networking person. So you need to figure out on the roadmap how and what skills you need, and these things can come from a lot of sources. And you'll see in the example that I gave you, it might be that you take one college course. Sometimes it might be a two-day training seminar. In another instance, it might be that you're going to read a book. You could attend a conference. You might do mentoring, on-the-job training, join a committee, serve as a mentor. There are many types of learning opportunities that will help you gain the skills and the knowledge that you need in order to be successful in that transition. And I wish I could list them all, but it's very customized because you're unique. So the roadmap really is unique in how you make that transition. So once you figure out, okay, I know what I want to do, I know the gap in my skill set, I have figured out what the roadmap needs to look like, I've gone and acquired those minimum skill sets. Now, how do I package all that together so that I get in the door. Well, let's talk about that now. We'll talk a little bit about how do you rebrand and recast. And I think Sarah said this a little bit. When your resumes, I probably would estimate that an average person over their lifetime spends probably 40 to 50 hours updating and revising their resume, probably more so in the last year. And what happens is what I call resume addiction. People will update their resume, tweak their resume, send their resume out, post it on job boards night after night after night, spend hour after hour after hour doing this with little success, because it's basically 0.005% opportunity that you will get a job on a job board. That's not good. Sometimes it is a problem with the resume. They might not have the right keywords, or it's selling. If you're trying to make a transition, you're only talking about the skills you had in your current job. If you're moving forward, now that you've done all this work, it has to be branded toward that future role. And it's very hard to be objective about your own skill set. So I always advise you or anybody that I'm working with to get a second opinion. Don't get a lot of opinions, because you'll keep changing your resume, and I don't want you to do that. But you should be able to use, and I know people say two or three resumes, I have never used more than one resume to help somebody make a transition, and that's the honest truth. So how do you do that? Well, when you're doing that skills analysis, you can also use the same website, the ONET Center, which is a government database. It's an incredible tool to help you figure out what are those keywords that you can use, that you can put in your resume, and that you can highlight your achievements in your resume, not responsibilities. If you're listing responsibilities and they're matching the resume and the job description, that's ineffective. You can't take a job description, cut and paste, and put it in your resume, which is what about 99% of the people that I know do. You will be just like everybody else, and you will never stand out. You have to ask yourself, what is it that I've done in terms of solving the problem? What actions did I take? And what result came out of it? It's very hard to do that, but there are lots and lots of books that can teach you how to do that. So once you have a resume, which is your marketing tool, which is your lead generation tool, that is the tool that needs to build the brand for everything else that you do. It is the basis of how you network. It is the basis of how you build a perception for where you're going. And it's how you handle these objections. And you're going to get objections all the time. You're going to get, I'm overqualified for the job. I'm underqualified for the job. You've been an executive too long. You don't have enough industry experience. If done right, those objections can be eliminated. And in the resume, the things that typically give you away are job titles and years on your education experience. So what I recommend a lot of people do is if you've been out of college, university for a long time, take the years off. If they are really interested in you and they do the background check, they're going to figure that out later. But you don't have to date yourself. And do not include high school in your education section. It's not necessary. But what you want to do is sometimes to get over the overqualified in the resume, what I often do is have people eliminate. If you've been a VP, I have them eliminate the VP, and I just put the functional role that they've held so that they can get in the door, so that they can prove their worth and their value. And then when you're filling out the job application, you can put exactly what the truth is. And it is still the truth. You still have that functional role, but a lot of the people that I work with that are over 55 are always getting that objection, and the objection comes from age bias, which exists, but also financial bias. They think people are going to want too much money. And even though you're worth it, if you don't get in the door, you never have a chance to sell that value. And so it can become very frustrating. And those are just a few tips that can help you get that resume in order. People say, how long should the resume be? It should not be more than 2 pages. And I know everybody says 1 page, but having written resumes for 10 years, I haven't quite mastered that art and don't know how I could. Two seems to be a number. In terms of interviewing, okay, now here's where it's extremely important. When you have that job description in front of you, make sure you cut and paste it, put it into a Word document, and for every job responsibility listed, you should have a very specific story that you can communicate in 60 to 90 seconds or less. So if there are 15 different aspects of the job that are required skills, for each of the bullet points, you should have one or two stories that you can tell. And you need to focus, again, if you're making that career transition, on how, not what you did in the past, but how what you learned in the past translates into that new role. And if you really think about the job requirements and how yours translate, because you'll know, because you know what's expected in that new role, you should be able to come up with effective stories. Not perfect stories, but effective. And an effective story is one where you talk about the problem or the action, or the problem in the situation. You talk about the steps that you took to handle or resolve the problem or the situation, and then you really highlight the result. Now, people say, I don't have any results. I can't talk about a 20% increase here, a 50% decrease here. There's always a result, and it doesn't always have to be in quantitative. It can be qualitative. So we need to think in terms of that mentality. In addition to that, everybody's always asking about how do you know when you're having a good interview? One, there's rapport. It's not one way. You feel like you're more in a dialogue than you are, you know, doing a QA session. There are three popular interview styles that I train our clients on, and the three include behavioral, functional, and case. Now, there's a lot of hoopla on behavioral interviewing. Essentially, the reason why HR people like behavioral interviewing is because it's supposed to trigger an emotional response that will elicit how you would actually behave on the job in a particular instance. So, for example, if someone says, tell me about a particular time when you were answering a customer service call and someone was irate, what most people will do is go, oh, I'm great at customer service. I can handle all kinds of problems. And, you know, everybody's always happy at the end of my calls. That is not what they're looking for. They want a very specific, concrete, step-by-step, here's why the customer called in, here was their complaint, here's how I opened the call, here are the steps that I took to resolve the call, here's five times, here are the people that I had to interact with to get the resolution, and here was the ultimate result. And they're going to probe, and their job, if they're doing it right, is to kind of bring you back to that call so that you feel that emotional response. And that is how they judge you, that on a behavioral interview. On a functional interview, this happens most often in kind of engineering type interviews where they might be asking you, what is a pipe in Unix, or what does cat mean, or, you know, I'd like you to go program some code if you were, you know, going to make enter or a login work. That's specifically functional. They're testing you on process or on experience. Somebody might say, how do you go about putting together a marketing plan for X? Or tell me your sales process selling into the government. They specifically are trying to acquire, has this person been there, done that, and how well do they know their domain or functional area of expertise? The case question, usually these are more in strategic situations, especially if you're going for a consulting job. What they want to do is they'll give you, it's like when you were tested in school and they give you the problem statement and you have to go and show all of your work. That is exactly what they're doing. And one of the questions that I ask people when I'm looking for a product manager is, go build me a door. And if they just stop there at that, like, what, huh? Well, I don't know what you mean. I never hire that person. I look for the person because problem solving is the fundamental requirement of a product manager. So I look for the people who say, well, what kind of door? What color? What purpose is the door for? Is it an indoor, an outdoor? Is it a garage door? Does it need to be handicap accessible? all of those sorts of things start to build a case. Or somebody might say, if I have a pen that never ran out of ink, how would you sell that to the public? What they're doing is they're assessing your ability to think strategically and to think out of the box. And then they have the teaser questions, which, you know, I think are stupid, but those typically are going to be if you're going for McKinsey-type job. They're really trying to see how smart you are. Face-to-face networking. So I believe, and what I recommend my clients do, is build new networks with industry associations and groups that you want to move into. So if you're a civil engineer and you wanted to get into nanotechnology because it's one of the fastest growing fields, and you still wanted to kind of be in engineering, we would figure out what nanotechnology associations exist in Nashua, New Hampshire that focus on engineering. How many groups are there? Where do they meet? How often do they meet? Who's on their board? What meetings do I need to attend? And meetings in and of themselves are useless. What you need to do is figure out what committees do they have and how can I participate? And you want to do that for several reasons. One, because it can be considered professional development. Two, you're seen more often. Three, you're getting involved. Four, when you're involved in all the other things above, you are building a new network. That new network will lead to new opportunities. Where most people fail is they go to one or two meetings and then they leave. Never going to work for you. I mean, I've been there, done that, seen my clients do it. It's ineffective. So you need to identify both industry and both profession. So industry would be like a biotech. A profession would be what you're doing, marketing, sales, engineering, whatever that may be. That's important. And then when you go to those networking events, you cannot go empty-handed. You need to go with a generic business card, even if you are unemployed. On that business card, it should just have your name, your email, and your phone number. Some people want to put on what their area of specialty is, and you know what? I think that can be great. But what I like to do is I don't give my business card to anybody that I don't speak to for more than 5 minutes. And if I'm speaking to somebody for 5 minutes and we're having a great networking session and they say, can I have your business card? I'm going to take out my nice pen, turn my business card over, and I'm going to write a little note to that person to remind them about what we said or what we do. So that way when they go back to their office, basically they're going to remember me over anybody else's business card. They're going to look and go, oh, who was that person? But they will remember you writing on that card before you give it to them, and then you will have a reason to call them. So think about that. In addition, I know networking is really, really hard. If you can find someone to go with, that's great. If you can't, you need to, and everybody hears this, your elevator pitch. I know it's boring, and it's really hard to do, but an elevator pitch is simple. You have to answer three things. One, and if you're networking at these events, you shouldn't have to say why you're there because you already know some of those people. But you really need to say who you are, that you're in transition if you don't have a job, and that you're there because you want to learn about new opportunities and the types of companies that would hire someone with your expertise. And if you put it that way and you don't say, I'm looking for a job, and you open it up to really asking questions, you will learn more about other people and how they can help you rather than promoting your own self. Because if you're promoting yourself, you're not learning anything, so then you have nothing to follow up on. So you need to say something about yourself. I could give you lots of different pitches, and we can talk about that, but it needs to be simple. It doesn't need to be complex. If you are not familiar with associations, there's something called the Book of Associations. You can go look at it at your local library. You can also search Google. Google is a great tool, and if you put a bunch of keywords together, anything like National Association of or International Association of or Society of, you will pretty much find it. There is an association for just about anything. So face-to-face networking is important, and it's so helpful. The second thing I would say about face-to-face networking is people ask me all the time, are job networking events, meaning i.e. the workforce development board, those sorts of things, are they helpful? I say, you know, I usually send my clients to those first so that they can teach themselves how to say the elevator pitch. Once in a while you might get a hit, but really you want to go to places where people really aren't looking for jobs, where they're really there for professional reasons and for business purposes. So that might be your ground zero to learn and to learn lingo and to learn how to do it, and then go spend your time at these special interest groups. And then my last slide is how do you network online? There's this whole concept which is foreign to, you know, mainstream consumers as well as baby boomers on how do I use this new area called social media in order to be effective in my job search. And I'm not going to talk about, there are 12 different types of social media, but I'm going to talk about the two that seem to be most popular. And the first one is LinkedIn, the second one is Twitter. On LinkedIn, first and foremost, you need to make sure that your resume and your LinkedIn account are similar, because LinkedIn essentially is your online CV. People are going to go there to see who you are. You have to determine as a job seeker if you want to have an open account, meaning anybody can view your public profile, or a closed account, meaning you only want people to view your profile if they know you in some way. They both have pros and cons. Then, once you have your account done, you invite your contacts. And I always say invite your business and your personal. This is colleagues, friends, family, because LinkedIn is built on the concept of multi-level marketing, like Amway or Melaleuca or those sorts of things. It wants you to get to know people so they can know people so they can know people. That's why this concept has been around for decades, but somebody figured out how to automate it. So you need to do that. And I always tell people, if you can get 50 people, you're going to have an excellent base to start networking with a group of people that will help you make your transition. Once you have your contacts, then I ask for recommendations. And the magic number that I have found is about 10. And you want 10 across managers, peers, and subordinates if you have them, because most HR people won't even look at your profile unless you have recommendations. So I think that is good. That is what I call the basic level of LinkedIn networking. That's ground zero. Now, how do you actually start to use the tool to be beneficial? Well, there's another level. And this level is, first and foremost, where I find some really great effectiveness is in the Q&A forum. So if you go in LinkedIn, there's something called questions and answers. And the questions and answers is organized by both industry and both topic. So let's say that you're a Unix engineer and you like the topic and you want to talk about it. Well, what you would do is you'd go and see what types of questions are being asked, and you'd become somebody who answers. The more you answer, the higher your profiles become, the more people see you. The more people who see you, the more opportunities you'll be exposed to. Takes some time, but it's time well spent. In addition to that, you can be someone who posts a question. Now, you want to use this for professional means. You don't want to go out there and say, hey, does anybody know where this job is or that job is? Those are things that you would want to post in the discussion forum. But Q&A is for professional purposes. It's to start to build credibility in a particular area. The second thing is the job search. Now, if you have not used it, there's a little tab at the top that says jobs. So you go in there, you click the job tab, you put in, let's pretend you're looking for a marketing manager job. You type in marketing manager, and then you type in your zip code. That will come back with a list of results that has, let's say it has 10 listings of jobs within that zip code. There's two things you can do at that point. You can click the job to read more about it, and that's always a wise thing to do. Or over to the right-hand column, you can see this thing that says, who can introduce you to this opportunity. That's what you want to click. You click on that, and then what happens is you will see something that says, they'll have maybe four or five names, and it will show your first level contacts. Your first level are those that you invited directly, or they invited you. You will see second level. Those are people that your first level know. And then you have to make a determination at that point to either do one of two things. If it's your first level contact, you might send a message via LinkedIn through InMail, or you might have their email in your Outlook and you might send them a message saying, hey, I noticed that you're connected to job opportunity and I'd like your help getting in the door. If it's a second level, so let's say you know Sally, and then Sally knows Linda. You would have to ask Sally to introduce you to Linda, who is the one who has the job opportunity. Again, you can do that by doing, if the feature is called Get Introduced By. But there's also a means, if you have an upgraded account, to introduce yourself to Linda directly. These are effective ways to network yourself into a job opportunity. I'm going to just put a word of caution in there because I've seen it happen before. If it's a third level connection and it does not go any deeper and you start making lots and lots and lots of in-mail introductions or you're trying to connect with people, that could cause you to be labeled as a spammer and they might shut your account off. So you have to be very careful about who you introduce because I've seen people get their accounts terminated. So I really try to play in the first level, second level network because those are both effective means. And if it's the recruiter directly, that's great because you usually have their emails because they want you to contact them. Another thing that you can do is in that status bar, and you see people use this a lot, is they'll post a status. Now, that's where you can post a status about if you're building a consulting business, you might say, oh, I just landed a new client today doing X, or had a great interview at blah, blah, blah for this type of job. That way, and I say don't do it more than two times a week because it could be irritating. Some people do it multiple times a day. That's what Twitter is for. Twitter is when you want to touch people multiple times. Twitter is a little different than LinkedIn. Twitter is more, I guess it's kind of organic and more addictive. So if you have a Twitter account, you would set up a Twitter account. You'd give yourself a name. It can be your first name. It can be any name you want, really. Mine is Career Goddess. So I branded that. Then there's something called tagging. And you have to go to Twitter to read about it. But what you would want to do is create tags so that what it does is it helps you figure out. So if you are into, let's just say you're into social media, what you would want to do is figure out who are all the social media leaders on Twitter. And Twitter can help you figure that out by using some of the tags and also by doing the Twitter search. What you would want to do is start to follow those people and see what are they Twittering about. And you'll see anything from them posting personal advice. They might post a YouTube blog. They might post an article that was of interest. They might ask their community a question, or they might poll them. So create a dialogue. So watch and listen. When it's pertinent, you would want to begin to engage in the discussion because when you engage in the discussion and it becomes meaningful, that's how you begin to create a following. So if you have something useful and interesting to say, people will begin to follow you. Once they begin to follow you, we don't know who these people are. They could be hiring managers. They could be recruiters. They could be people who know people who will send your tweets to other people. It's important and it's very specific in topics. Now, some people have multiple Twitter accounts. They have a personal Twitter where they'll only let their friends and family in, and then they have a business Twitter. You can manage multiple Twitter accounts. To make it easy on yourself, if you have an iPhone or a BlackBerry, you go to Twitter, and then you can integrate, like my Twitter is integrated with my iPhone and my Facebook. So I usually just use Twitter on my iPhone, and I can hit two apps at one time. What your goal with Twitter is to become a social media topic guru. So you would want to Twitter on things that are meaningful. And you need to say it in 140 characters or less, because seeing broken Twitters is not good. And that's really difficult, because it's almost like you have to come up with a new elevator pitch every single time you make a tweet. But if you get it right, then you're doing a couple of things. You're on your resume, on your business card, on your email signature, you're saying to, especially if you're a baby boomer, you're saying to hiring managers, I'm current. I'm current. I'm a social media person. You don't have to be highly active. You just have to be versed in it. So your resume, your business card, your signature on your Outlook should have all of your links so that people can find you and they can see. So you start, what I said earlier, build that perception that you are keeping pace with skills. And that concludes the career management, networking, and interview topic.
This is Jack Molesky, the moderator again. Thank you very much, Linda. That was a terrific presentation. Again, I'd just like to remind everyone, keep your mute on, and which is star 6, and we will have questions and answers after Caleb goes through his presentation. So, Caleb, it's up to you.
Hi there, everybody. Great talk so far. I just want to talk about consulting as a career. I've been placing folks in consulting jobs since 1982 or so, and co-owner of a business since 1984, placing technical folks and writers. And it's a great way of agencies are a great way of finding contract work. The work itself tends to be more targeted than work that you might find on a permanent basis, because it tends to be project-based or focused on one particular task. Working with an agency is a great way to start, because an agency will market your skills to potential customers. I'd recommend getting to know the agency, speak to them about your background and also about their expertise. Make sure that they understand what you do. One of my favorite examples from years ago was when a competitor was also recruiting for a client at DEC in Stowe, Mass. The client confided in me that they were getting resumes for people who had written case studies, when in fact the client was actually looking for somebody with computer-aided software engineering or case background. It's the case of an agent not understanding the client's needs and sending inappropriate resumes. I think that in some ways, due to technology, we're more reliant on keyword searches as kind of a base for all placements and connections. So as previous talkers mentioned, keywords are very important. Again, working with an agency, I would recommend developing mutual trust through communication. If you're a match for a job, the agent should understand your background and be able to speak to the customer on your behalf in a knowledgeable way. When you're dealing with an agent, also, they should, if you've agreed to pursue an opportunity through an agent, the agent should reveal the name of the client that is looking for a contractor. Keep track of where you've been submitted by agencies, and also if you're pursuing opportunities on your own, it's very important that you keep track of those opportunities, whether it's a permanent job or a contract position that you pursued on your own or through an agent. Keep a log of those discussions, including rate discussions, so that there's no confusion later on. Also with contracting, I mean, if you present yourself to an agent or directly to a client, make sure you keep in in touch with them, call them back when you say you will, keep them informed about your availability, and update them with any new skills that you may have gained. Contracting can be a great way to get in the door at a company. It's typically not a good opportunity for someone to make a career change. Usually if there's a contract or a targeted need, then the client is looking for someone who's done something similar in the past. Even though it's a temporary position, because it's a temporary position, clients are pretty specific about their needs, and there's not a lot of wiggle room. There are different ways of working on contract. Through an agent like my company, we hire our folks on a W-2 basis, where we pay into unemployment and Social Security, and the folks are protected by workman's compensation insurance. Our clients are protected by liability insurance and I think a dishonesty bond as well. If you work directly with a client, those protections would not necessarily be in place. If you're working on a Form 1099 where taxes are not withheld, you'd be responsible for handling your own taxes and collecting funds from your client. Working on a W-2, the cash flow is more regular, like a regular employee on a 1099. You would often have to wait to be paid by your client. I guess I also wanted to talk about marketing your skills. If you're working directly with a client, you'd be responsible for marketing your own skills to the client, and that's sometimes hard to do for someone who's actually currently working on a job. An agent can help by marketing your skills while you're working, either for them or on another assignment or another permanent job. I consider our company a marketing arm for our people. It's important that you do this in an organized way, and again, keeping after your contacts or with any agent that you're working with. An agency can also help market specific skills and pull them out of your background and call attention to them when dealing with a client. It's not always possible when you're dealing certainly with an automated search process where you sent in a resume and it's being reviewed by keywords only and doesn't have the personal touch that an agent would offer or a connection you've made perhaps through your own networking. I also want to talk briefly about rates. I mean, the rates are, they've remained pretty stable over the last couple of years, although it's driven in part by how many folks are available, so there are more people looking for work than actual jobs at the moment, so it's something to be flexible about. Rates for contract work, it's not like you're making a permanent commitment at a specific salary, so it doesn't necessarily lock you into a rate forever. If you're flexible, you can get you're perhaps more likely to get your foot in the door, and once you've gained specific experience in a given area, you could ask for more at a later date. Rates are regional, as are salaries. There are lots of sources on the web for salary searches. I won't go into that at the moment. I wanted to talk also about your resume. Keyword searches are often the beginning of every search, whether it is through an agent or at a client company. Don't be afraid of repeating some keywords. Remember that the audience for your resume will vary, and don't assume that your audience will know, for example, that Sybase is a database company, or that DECnet is a networking product, or that VMS is an operating system. You really have to spell it out. Keep that in mind when you're looking for jobs on your own or through an agent, both permanent or contract. as Sarah Alvarado suggests, brand your resume. Target it towards specific jobs. It's actually pretty commonplace in my business to have folks who have a couple versions of their resumes, especially if we're also looking for permanent employment for them. A contract resume might be different, might be more targeted, mentioning perhaps more keywords. An agent would be able to help you tailor your resume for a particular job. One thing that people have asked me about, especially in an economy like this, worried about age discrimination and feeling overqualified. I think some of the earlier folks have made some great suggestions about removing dates of education. In contract work, I really haven't come across any age discrimination that I could really. I think people are being hired for their skill set, and it really doesn't matter how old they are. But if you're concerned about that, you can drop off dates of education. I do not recommend dropping earlier job history, if it's professional, off your resume completely. What I'd recommend is perhaps something like consolidating them and saying something, for example, prior to 1985, held positions in software engineering with Digital Equipment Corporation, Sun Microsystems, and Rational Software. Details upon request. It tells the audience, by doing so, it tells the audience that for your resume that you have previous experience. It doesn't say it's 112 years of experience. The content of this sort of consolidation might help in a later key search because it's mentioning specific types of specific company names, and also in the example I gave of software engineering, it's also mentioning a specific skill set. Contracting jobs, at least the kinds that we get, tend to last 3 to 6 months in length. They are often renewed. We have folks, some of our government customers have kept people on contract for, some of our people have been on board for something like 15 years doing engineering work. I know that the next con call will be talking about working with government, and there are some great opportunities there for long-term contract work. And I can talk to people afterwards about specific things related to that. To date, our work with the government has been mostly engineering. Another busy area for us is publications and communications, marketing, and things like that. So I don't really think I have too much more to say. It's part of your networking process, working with another marketing arm, an agency, or marketing yourself directly with customers for contract work is quite similar to marketing yourself for permanent employment in terms of how you present yourself, but the ways of finding out about the jobs are somewhat different. So, Jack, that's all I have to say, I'm afraid.
Okay, this is Jack Molesky, the moderator again. We're going to go to the question and answer period, but before I do, I just wanted to mention that we do have Con Call Part 2 on Monday, June 1st at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Bill Costello will talk about federal government jobs, and for those of you obviously read the newspaper, the federal government's been doing a lot of hiring. We also will have Lanning Levine, who has done some work on seminars in terms of finding jobs, also on that con call. So if you haven't signed up for that, you should do so. Again, if you do drop off this call, the recording of this will be posted on the Deck Connection website. So we'll go to questions and answers for any of the panel members at this point.
Okay.
any questions? Hello? Are there any questions from the audience?
I have a question for Linda. Can you hear me? Whoops.
Yes, I'm here.
So the question is for face-to-face networking, and I think you have some very good recommendations. Any statistics on, you know, how poorly the job seeker type of networks produce results versus the, you know, being a participant in the professional societies?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I don't have, like, physical statistics because I don't know of any industry group that yet tracks that. But I attend a lot of networking events with my clients because that's the thing they most fear. And I can tell you just from my own experience that I have not seen a lot of success for people who are attending job clubs. And I'm not saying that because I think they're ineffective. As I get, again, I think they do serve a wonderful purpose for people. But where I really see, where I see networking being very effective is first and foremost figuring out, one, how to leverage your own network. And again, people say I don't have a network, but they do, and I teach them how to look at it that way. And, excuse me, and then connecting with somebody like, it could be a recruiter, it could be a career coach, it could be a friend, someone else who has a network. It just takes one person to open the door to dozens and dozens and dozens. So when I'm networking, for example, let me give you an example. When I have a guy right now, he's been in the construction business on the industrial commercial real estate side. So he's done that, and he wants to get into medical devices. Well, okay, he's been in sales, done a lot of sales of service. In medical devices, that's a product. You have to switch the mentality. But what I found was I didn't have a connection in medical device industry. So what I did is I went out and I went to my own network and I said, hey, I'm looking for one or two people that I can speak to in the medical device field that will tell me a little bit about X. So what I did was I went and found two people, built relationships with them over the course of 2 months, and that person that I was working with who would never have gotten hired, I made a referral into one of the medical device people just as a, hey, I'd like you to meet with this guy, and this was after I built a relationship. Remember, networking is not a one-time meeting. So I had to build a network so that I could then introduce some of the people that I worked to that network, and then that person ended up getting the job. And it was because we reached out to one person and not 50 people. I don't feel that networking works if you're out. When somebody gives me their business card, if I'm out and somebody gives me their business card and I don't even know what the person's name is and they're just business card givers, one, it goes in the garbage because the person hasn't spent the time to get to know me and I haven't spent the time to get to know someone, and I would never recommend someone that I don't feel at least has a fundamental, basic, professional etiquette, because if they're doing that, what are they going to be doing in the meeting? And so I always say spend more time finding the one or two or the three right people, whether you do that face-to-face, whether you do that through an association, whether you do that through friends and family. I actually think you need all three of those. Find the three topmost three people that you can network with, and then spend time getting to know those people, and then when the time is right, and the time could be a day, a week, a month, 2 months, then you have a relationship, and you can form that relationship many ways. It can be coffee, lunches, dinners, lots of different things. Then you reach out and ask for help, and it's through that network that you will meet more people from that one individual than you could over a course of a year or two. I don't know if that answers it, but that's how I think of networking.
Great advice. Thank you.
Additional questions?
Yes, I have a question about headhunters. in the old days, you could hire a headhunter and they'd listen to what kind of job you wanted. They'd work with you, they'd present you with opportunities, and you'd interview, etc., etc., and they'd stick with you. My impression is that these days, since the market has turned on its head and there are more people looking than there are jobs, that headhunters are interested in placing you in one particular job or jobs they've been hired to place, you know, to hire for, and then once you don't get hired for that job, they'll drop you, and there's no permanence. Is there such a thing these days as a headhunter who will work with you through thick and thin, or has that gone away? And that's for any of the presenters.
I believe that nowadays the headhunters will work for you because, like I stated before, and this is Sarah, right now it's an employer's market, and they're going to be fussy. And so what the headhunters want to do and be able to do is to keep the rapport going, because behind one company is going to be another company that's going to be needing the skills. And the expectations today are that the companies are testing out lots of agencies and so forth, and what they want to do is see how, one, fast they can turn a candidate around to present in front of them. That's my thinking right now, and it's also based on a lot of folks that I do network. So the bottom line is, no, they won't forget you, but of course it's a two-way street. You can't just wait to hear from them. You also need to be checking with them as well.
This is Linda. I've seen similar, the way that I kind of look at recruiters, I mean, they have a fundamental job to fill. They need to match their talent with the job rec. And they are paid a commission, which is sales, right? So they have to spend the time and energy on the people that are going to help them close that job spec. And as much as they might want to court you and have you in their network, and they do, they want to be able to develop that, but their fundamental job is sales. And so when the requirement calls for a certain type of person, they need to, if they don't have it in their network, they need to go find that. And that can create, you know, that can create some tension if you've been with that recruiter for a long time, because they know you, they know your background, they've been loyal to you, and they want to continue to be that way, but they just might not have the bandwidth to help do that. Or it might be, as Sarah said, some of these organizations that they used to work with might be pulling back on those recruiting dollars. So as much as they really want to help you, their hands are tied as well.
Okay, and I guess I've heard that recruiters who you work with to get a job you might find on a job board somewhere or through some company's website, they'll insist on having an exclusive with you, sort of like a realtor, I guess, and sort of discourage or prevent you from posting your resume on Dice.com or Monster or whatever search website you're looking at, and that may cause some problems also. Can anybody comment on that?
So you're talking about like blasting your resume?
Well, I've heard firsthand experience from people who were working with a recruiter who, you know, had a particular job or a couple jobs they were trying to place them in, and that person said, don't you dare put your resume on Dice.com. I want an exclusive with you. When that recruiter really was not interested in helping them in general, but rather helping them get the particular job that he or she was trying to recruit for.
Well, what I would suggest is be upfront with the recruiter. If you, you know, for example, if you're working with a recruiter, it's fair game to say I'm also working with another team, because recruiters are competitors, and challenges is who can get number one for the job person, you know, person that's looking for a job, is he or she wants the job. Meanwhile, on the other hand, you're dealing with recruiters that are very, very competitive, and they also have quotas to meet in some respects. And the bottom line is as an employee, now being on the other side, I'd rather deal with a recruiter that I can have a communication with And I usually up front when I first meet that recruiter, if you get that feeling like this is somebody that I want to work with. On the other hand, if you're during that first conversation, if they're asking the same questions that perhaps other people ask and the conversation's like only less than 2 minutes, is it really worth the time that you want to spend with that recruiter? There's so many recruiters out there that it's okay to be fussy, not to just, you know, because I want a job. Be fussy and work with that right recruiter, because in the long run, you'll, like Linda was saying before, you'll maintain that relationship with the recruiter through the years. If something should happen that you need to speak with a recruiter again, you'll always go back to that recruiter that you've been working with. The one thing I want to add, even though I've been unemployed, I can't tell you how many resumes I still receive from people that, you know, are looking, you know, for jobs and things like that, and in due diligence, you know, I try to still maintain contact with them, and I'll send their resumes out to the appropriate networks. Again, there's different types of recruiters, and it depends upon how they come across to you. It's not so much of how you come across to them, but it's how they are with you, because you are the one that they need to help. You do not need to help them, only with the questions that they're asking, and they do have a job to do. And for me, it's very important to be very sincere with the person that you're working with, the recruiter working with the candidate, and also help them in their process of looking for a job as far as what do they think of the resume. And one thing I want to bring up, and I believe Linda had brought this up, when you're doing your resume, the worst thing in the world is writing it yourself. Do not turn around and ask 15 people about how that resume is going to look. Because what it's like is looking at a newspaper ad and showing it to 5 different people, and they're all going to give you 5 different answers. So talk to people that you know that are knowledgeable, that have a history of working with resumes, and really can see and feel what you're feeling. And I wanted to point that out. And one last thing I wanted to point out that hasn't been brought up yet is job fairs. Right now, I'm sure that you've all been reading about job fairs, how 10,000 people go to one specific job fair, this, that, and everything else. Haven't done a lot of job fairs in my life. The one thing that I really, really suggest you have to think about before you present your resume is, what does my resume look like from the first 25 people that have already talked to this recruiter? And a long time ago, I learned being a recruiter is that that person, that candidate, if they come up to you, they need to be able to sell themselves in less than 2 minutes. When you're dealing at a job fair and you don't have experienced recruiters there, you want to make sure that you're very precise in 2 minutes. And when you see them jotting down things, that's a good sign, because there's some qualities that perhaps were not on your resume that they want to highlight and be able to bring back to the hiring team. So I just wanted to add that in, because it's very, very competitive at a job fair. Sometimes you may just want to send your resume in or call into the company. It's okay to do that. Those are some of the creative approaches, because a lot of times you have people, when they're looking for a job, they're getting very traditional, because Joe next door does it one way, I'm going to do it that way. Try to be different than Joe and find a different rock to crawl under and see if there's some other things that you may be able to do that's different than what Joe's doing. Or even in the newspapers, when they tell you how to go find a job or who's hiring and so forth, you'll say, how can I take that a step further and be more creative? As far as I'm concerned, creativeness is the name of the game.
Hi there. This is Caleb. I also wanted to comment about the gentleman's inquiry about working with agents, headhunters, as he calls them. I think when an agency asks you not to submit your resume on to a job board, the request is probably twofold, in that there are often clients who are actually doing the hiring who will post job openings on job boards, but also ask recruiters to help find people. And if you send your resume to a job board and the agency does as well, sends the resume along to the client as well, the agency is probably not going to get a fee depending on the timing of the submittal. So the agent might do quite a bit of work to represent you with a client, only to find that the client has found your resume online. So it's a selfish, a sort of business decision to ask people to not post on job boards. I personally don't know how effective they are. It's sort of like throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall. I think you're better off with more targeted approaches. I think that Sarah mentioned job fairs. I think they're a great opportunity. You're competing with people, but you get a chance to meet real people as opposed to just dealing with an email address at a company. So if you have a real person that you could follow up with. Those are my thoughts. Thank you.
And also, just to add on to you, Caleb, remember one thing, if you're utilizing agencies, the other piece, too, is don't forget that in-house they have recruiters. So if the recruiters can find someone, and that's why, first of all, you have to post a job because, again, like I stated before, there's that 10-day internal posting, which sometimes managers make it external at the same time. And if they can save money, companies want to do that. And so the piece what I'm saying is a lot of times you'll find internal recruiters asking the question, are you working with an agency? Because if they find that you're working with an agency, then there's a contract. We have to check to see if our agency has been on the approved vendor list. Because in-house recruiters know exactly what vendors are being utilized. And if it's an unsolicited resume from a vendor, then they will not look at that resume because of some ramifications that can happen, and there was no contract brought up, you know, put together between the company and that of, say, the agency.
So in that case, the recruiter can't help you, and you'd need to work your own submission to the company. Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that the recruiter should be upfront with you. If they don't have permission to work on the job and the okay to present resumes and candidates and get a fee for placing people, then they should be upfront with you that it's a bit of a long shot.
I just want to add one thing, though. Sometimes, which turns off a lot of internal recruiters, is the fact that, and I'm not knocking agencies, I respect them highly, I've worked with agencies before, is the fact that the agencies tend to sometimes not work with the recruiters, and what they'll do is go behind the recruiter's back and send the resume over straight to the hiring manager. And that can cause a lot of issues, especially if there's been no contract with that specific agency working with that of the company. And the unfortunate around that, it puts the applicant in the middle because behind the scenes there's all this rumbling going on and this, that, and everything else. And it would have been nice if the resume was received by the recruiter first and then maybe, you know, if the agency then sends it in, because the recruiter can take the stand and say, well, we've already received this resume on this date. And again, utilizing the ATS systems, which is the applicant tracking systems, it's all documented. So there's a lot that does go on behind the scenes that a candidate really needs to understand.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions here? This is Jack Molesky, the moderator. Is there any other questions? If not, I just, first of all, I want to thank the audience for participating in this call, and again, June 1st is the next one, and I also want to thank the panelists who did a terrific job, in my opinion, and have a good evening.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you for coordinating this.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linda and Sarah.
Yes.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you and listening to your topics.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye now.
Talk again. Bye.
Thank you.